Welcome to the show, everybody.
We're here today bringing you another exciting story.
That's right.
We're going back in time.
Gonna go back in time.
We're going to the Middle East. We're here talking about the Ottoman Empire.
It's more than just a piece of furniture, people.
Suleiman the Magnificent was one of the most beloved and longest ruling sultans in the Ottoman Empire in the 16th century, and he fell in love with his concubine, Hürrem. Hürrem went down in history as the first consort to legally marry the sultan. They wrote poetry to each other, they're buried next to each other, they were obsessed with each other. And this totally changed the world.
Let's do it.
Hey there, friends, come listen well. Eli and Diana got some stories to tell. There's no matchmaking or romantic tips. It's just about ridiculous relationships. A lover might be any type of person at all, an abstract concept or a concrete wall. But if there's a story worth a second glance, we'll put it in our show, Ridiculous Romance.
A production of iHeartRadio.
So if you're a longtime listener of the show, you know that we definitely put as much effort as we can into getting these name pronunciations right. And some of these are definitely outside of our normal speaking tongue. But we did look up what we can, and we hope we nail them right. And if we make an absolute massacre of it, then please don't hesitate to reach out and correct us. We'd love to tell everybody in the next episode, you know, how it's really said.
I did look up one pronunciation, and the pronunciation was just in Cyrillic. And I was like, this is not helpful. I don't know how to pronounce anything in Cyrillic.
So you have to kind of try and find someone from that region actually saying it out loud. So sometimes I look for news reports or something where they actually say it, but it can be tricky.
Mm-hmm.
So we do our best.
Yeah, and when you're in the 16th century, there's nothing. No videos exist of anyone talking about Hürrem.
Yeah.
So yeah, Suleiman. We'll start with him. He was appointed the governor of Manisa, which is now Theodosia, a town in Crimea. It's on the coast of the Black Sea. He lived there till he was 26, ruling that province until his father passed away. And Suleiman had to take the throne. So he goes back to Constantinople, he gets to work. And as we said, he's considered to be one of the greatest sultans in history. And he was the longest reigning. He ruled from 1520 to 1566. He personally led forces in several conflicts to expand the Ottoman Empire by like 70% or something.
Wow.
Eventually ruled over 25 million people. So the Ottoman Empire is enormous.
Like, massive.
It cannot be understated
what
a power they were. And he brought major Muslim cities like Baghdad. He brought Balkan regions like Croatia and Hungary. And he brought most of North Africa into the Ottoman Empire. So if you're a geography nerd and you want to look at a map, you can see that it really expanded a lot of space.
Wanted to add, too, if he ruled over an empire of 25 million people, in the year 1500, the entire world population was only about 461 million. So that's a pretty hefty chunk.
Yeah.
That's a lot smaller than today.
And I thought it was interesting. I didn't know this, but the Ottoman Empire really prided itself on how multicultural it was. So they never, they weren't really super interested in trying to convert you to any particular religion. They didn't want you to get rid of your language. So a lot of people were multilingual. They had a lot of religions mixing together, a lot of different styles of art and everything going on. And they were really proud of that. They liked that.
What a great idea.
I know. I was like, that's dope. He was known as lawgiver to his Ottoman subjects because there are two sets of laws there. There's the Sharia law. That's sacred law. It comes from Islam and their holy books. And no one has any control over that. You can be the most powerful sultan in the world. You can't change the Sharia law.
These are from above.
Exactly.
Heavenly laws for mankind on earth.
But there's also some like mundane shit that was never written down. There was no commandments made about taxes. So there's some human law, I guess you could say, called kanuns. And that handled more, you know, shit like taxes, like land ownership, criminal law, that sort of stuff.
Right.
And each sultan would kind of issue their own kanuns every time they took power. And so what Suleiman did was take all the previous rulings. He got rid of any duplications or contradictions, and he made one comprehensive code that lasted for 300 years.
Okay.
So I guess sultans that came after him were like, yeah, that looks good. I don't want to do all that work.
This guy protected the Jewish subjects of his empire for centuries to come. He issued a ruling formally denouncing blood libels against Jews because of a suggestion by his favorite doctor and dentist, a Spanish Jew named Moses Haman.
Mm-hmm.
Just like,
Suleiman the Magnificent, great to see you again. Your teeth look fantastic. Just going to scrape a little enamel and take care of a few things. While I've got you, I was thinking, you know how you like a multicultural world of different languages and religions and everything? What about no more blood libels on Jews? Just a thought.
That's a great idea, Doc. You know what? I think I'm going to do that. I'm going to do that, and I'm going to floss more.
denounce anti-Semitism and floss more, please. I wish my dentist was so explicit, you know?
I don't know. My dentist tells me to floss.
She's never specifically mentioned stopping anti-Semitism. We can imagine she probably would agree to it.
I think so.
I hope so. Otherwise, we need a new dentist.
I know, right? Jeez. Anyway.
Suleiman's laws cut down on punishments requiring death or mutilation. Instead, he moved more towards imposing fines, right? He himself was a poet and a goldsmith, so already kind of an artist himself, and then he was a major patron of the arts as well. He presided over the golden age of the Ottoman Empire in arts. There was literature and theology and philosophy and architecture, just booming. Many major Turkish cities still boast buildings from this architect, Mimar Sinan. His buildings are still up in their skyline today.
They're gorgeous. Look them up. They're just beautiful. It's an amazing architecture.
Yeah.
Check it out.
Historians note that while Suleiman's father wrote poetry in Persian, and many sultans were influenced by Persian artistic styles, Suleiman helped the Ottoman Empire assert its own artistic legacy. Mm-hmm. Like, this was part of really coming into their own with an artistic voice, which I think really helps just define, you know, an era and a nation.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You
know. Yeah.
It's kind of that marrying of all those different styles from all over his empire that made for this incredibly interesting and beautiful style of their own that you wouldn't get anywhere else, because everywhere else they were like, if you're not white, get the fuck out. Or if you're not this religion, get the fuck out.
He also, another way he broke tradition, was that he married a concubine in his harem, a woman known as Roxolana.
Roxolana was born in a town as part of the Kingdom of Poland at the time. Today it's in Western Ukraine. Sometime before 1520, maybe 1517, she's captured by Crimean Tatars during a slave raid. She's brought to Constantinople, and she's selected for the imperial harem by Suleiman's mother as a gift for him upon his ascension to the Sultancy.
Okay. Can you explain to me a little more about a harem? Because I got an image in my head about a harem, and it is probably incorrect. I bet it's a little racist. It's probably, in either case, very stereotypical.
Yeah.
Probably factually inaccurate. So let's talk harems.
I'd love to talk harems in our segment, Harem Talk. So harems, you're probably thinking, are like hundreds of beautiful women that the Sultan can just fuck at any time.
Right. That's what I was thinking.
Right.
Okay.
And they're just laying around waiting to
silk pillows,
be slept with.
Purple curtains, gold beads on their bellies.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
That's the image in my head, because I'm thinking about that old restaurant, Imperial Fez.
That was such a cool spot.
It was. When I think harem, I just think of that restaurant.
But with a lot more naked ladies.
A lot more naked ladies, yeah. And a lot less white people sitting around dining.
Well, you're right and you're wrong.
Okay.
So a harem is made up not only of concubines, but also wives.
Okay.
Servants.
Sure.
Female relatives of the Sultan. And, of course, eunuchs, very important part of the harem. So not everybody in the harem is having sex with the Sultan. They're just, like, in the palace, running shit, taking care of his home. The larger the harem, the more power and wealth the Sultan was seen to have. Sometimes they get up to the hundreds.
Wow.
Suleiman's princely harem had about 17 women in it. Most of the men and women in the harem are bought as slaves to ensure obedience. But some were actually free. The main wives were free women because you couldn't marry a slave. So if you were a wife, you were not a slave. But everyone in the harem was given a quality education. And afterwards, the men and women within the harem would sometimes be married off to each other. So only a small number of the women in the harem were actually there for him to sleep with.
Okay.
And they're governed by the Valide Sultan, which is typically the Sultan's mother. She's the most powerful member of the harem.
Yeah.
She runs everybody in it.
Makes sense.
They all look to her. And she was also responsible for educating her son on the intricacies of politics. She was a member of the imperial court. So she had kind of a lot of power within the palace, at least. And the next most powerful positions in the harem were the concubines who rose through the ranks. They would get titles like the favorite, the fortunate, and the wife. Glenn Close, is that you? And so these women held an equivalent rank to legal wives, and they were given their own servants, their own apartments. They were paid more in income. They got like a yearly income, and you would get more the more, you know, higher up you were.
Right.
So it's kind of a corporate ladder kind of action going on. Obviously, this is all for the sake of reproduction, right? He's sleeping with a lot of women because then you have better odds of having a big family and one of them attains their majority and are able to take over for you, right? But concubines were actually seen as more legitimate mothers of heirs because they had no influence over their sons.
Oh, okay.
Legal wives would jockey for power because they would improve their own situation. If their son became sultan, of course, they were then, you know, in a higher position themselves. But slave women had none of that was recognized at all. So if their son became sultan, it really meant nothing to them. You know, it had made no difference to their lives whatsoever.
Right.
So in the eyes of the Ottoman Empire, it was better off to have an heir by a concubine than by a legal wife.
Now, eunuchs were also an important element to a harem. These were slaves who were castrated. And it was important to note that there were white and black slaves in the Ottoman Empire, but they were still treated very differently. Black slaves would have everything removed.
What?
Penis and testicles totally separated from their bodies. And then they were put in charge of the harem because they lacked the equipment to be, you know, interested in women or be able to have sex with women.
Oh, give me a break.
Yeah. White slaves only had a portion of their penis removed.
Oh, thanks.
And they wouldn't have access to the harem at all. Eunuchs were usually castrated before puberty by their Christian or Jewish captors because Islam actually prohibited the act of castration. So you've got the salespeople basically bringing slaves from here to there being like, step right up, get your unpaid interns here, right?
Oh, we've Lord.
Already castrated them, so you ain't got to worry about getting your hands dirty with none of that. We catch them, we cut them, you buy them.
You know you need unique eunuchs.
Wow.
Yeah, they were fine with having castrated slaves, but you couldn't actually castrate them yourself.
So, similarly, female slaves, often white Christian girls, because it was forbidden for Muslim women to be concubines.
Mm-hmm.
So, some of them were captured, like Roxolana. Others were sold by their own families sometimes. There's a blog called Sedef's Corner. He says, though these practices seem barbaric and impossible to understand for us, the Sultan's harem was a place for a young girl to receive a thorough education in housekeeping, gardening, and languages, and live in comfort and luxury. Some would get married off to high-ranking government officials and get a chance to head up their own household. So it was almost like kind of a career path in this fucked up way.
Yeah, like that corporate ladder again. You know, it's so hard to think about today, but you fuck your way to the top, essentially.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. It reminds me a little bit of, you know, what we've talked about in earlier episodes about, you know, how women are put in these situations where they're like kind of enslaved and then told like, but it's good for you. Look how many opportunities you're getting by being stuck mm-hmm. in this situation. So I don't know. That's a sticky area for sure.
Yeah.
But it's understandable. I mean, I don't know. Yeah, look at all the opportunities you're being given. Also, you know, you don't have the free will to make choices of your own.
Right.
I don't know. At a certain point in history, that was a get. You know, that was like, oh, cool. I have opportunities. I ain't fucking worried about being able to have choices to make on my own. That's not something my brain is even considering.
Yeah,
but
you could almost see like the fathers and mothers being like, I mean, you're going to get fucked at some point in your life. It should be the Sultan. If it's going to be anybody, because that means you're going to be taken care of, you're going to be in luxury. If you have a child by him, even if it's a girl, you still are taken care of for your rest of your life. And again, you're in this palace being fed really well. I mean, you don't have to really worry about a lot of the normal shit that people out in the streets were dealing with. So it might have seemed like if you had a pretty enough daughter, yeah, it was a good choice for her. A weird job. A strange, strange job. So into this harem situation, Roxolana walked, right? This is what she's getting herself into at this point. And I do want to say her legacy is a little bit shrouded in hearsay and mystery because you weren't allowed to see any of these women outside of the palace. They weren't allowed to leave. You weren't allowed to talk to them or anything like that, especially if you were a man. So there's no like firsthand accounts of her life. A lot of this is just legend or gossip that was written at the time. But it seems safe to say that while she was only 15 years old, she was pretty determined to make this situation work for her.
So let's pause there and take a quick commercial break. And we'll hear how she did that right after this.
Well, welcome back, everybody. I hope that was a lovely commercial break. We're here talking about Roxolana.
So Roxolana was probably born Alexandra Lizowska, but she was called Roxolana because of her red hair. She's depicted in paintings as having white skin, red hair, and green eyes. But they always point out, no painter ever actually saw any of the women in the harem. Like we said, that was totally forbidden. So most of these depictions were probably based on gossip.
So inside the harem, there's several different classes of women that you could be. There's the Iqbals. They were like chambermaids. They still had to be beautiful. Everyone had to be pretty. They all had to be eye candy. But it wasn't just looks that made a courtesan the sultan's favorite. There's beautiful women all over the palace at all times. So you needed something extra to kind of stand out.
Mm-hmm.
You need personality, honey.
Gotta have a gimmick.
Yeah, you gotta have a gimmick.
Uh-huh.
What's your angle? There were Gadiq, who did not sleep with the sultan, but they just served him food in the evenings. And they basically just had to be hot and that's it. Like, they were just like hot servers.
They're the cocktail waitresses.
Mm-hmm.
At the cheetah.
And then the lowest tier were women who hadn't really been selected yet. They were just there for a one-night stand to see how it went.
Wow. Is the stashing trial
period.
Yeah,
being trained at the restaurant.
Yeah.
So the head bitch in charge, the Valid Sultan, she gets to arrange the Sultan's schedule with all these women. So the girls are really trying to get in with her. You know what I mean? Because the more you see the Sultan, the more you sleep with the Sultan, mm-hmm. the more likely you are to get pregnant by the Sultan.
Yes.
And if you have a son, that means not only you're his favorite and you get more power, more income, nicer shit, all that stuff, but also it meant they would never sleep with him again.
See ya.
It was a one and done rule with concubines because they didn't want you to have more than one son that
right.
you would be trying to put above the other one or something.
Right.
They were like, you get one and that's it. So it was kind of like, sweet, I can retire. To have a son was the retirement plan.
Wow.
So it's a little bit weird because it's his mom. So the mom's basically picking out who her son's going to sleep with that night.
Right.
So I don't know about y'all, but that would be odd for me to have my mom be like, how about this one? I'm like, ugh.
I don't know. Your mom called me and she said, out of all the guys Diana's hanging out with, you're the straight one.
You're the straight one. Yeah, that's true. That's true. And it was pointed out, of course, he's still the sultan. So if there's a woman he sees in the palace, whether his mom likes her or not, and he wants to sleep with her, he's going to sleep with her, right? I mean, you know. But mostly, he didn't see them unless she arranged for him to see them. Because they had their own area of the palace and everything.
Right.
So anyway, long story short, you needed to be in with this Valid sultan. You wanted her to like you. And then after the mom died, the sultan's wife would rule the harem. So you were probably pretty nice to whoever his current favorite was as well, just in case.
Oh,
you
yeah.
know what I mean? You'd be like, oh, well, if the Valid sultan doesn't like me now, maybe the next one will. So
right.
I'll be friends with her kind of thing.
You're hedging bets on who he's going to marry.
Mm-hmm.
This is like a real mean girl society kind of thing.
I was just about to say, like, this is like a real stressful cafeteria situation.
Yeah. Yeah, and Suleiman especially, it's not like he was one of these useless rulers who was just laying around waiting for the next woman to come in and fuck him. Like, this was a busy guy.
Mm-hmm.
He was doing things pretty constantly.
Yeah.
So that was part of it, too, of just like, you know, that's part of why he was waiting to be sent, you know, whatever woman was decided for that particular night, because it wasn't like he was just lounging around hanging out with them and saying, all right, you can stay, the rest of you leave, or anything like that.
Yeah, and she, the Valid Sultan, would be like, I'm looking for the best of the best, because the people who sleep with him are the people we're trying to get to reproduce with him. So we want only the best. So that's why the education really matters that they're getting.
And Roxolana, like the other girls that Suleiman's mother had her eye on, got this great education.
Mm-hmm.
She learned to play instruments. I mean, they were all taught to dance and recite poetry and literature, geography, history, like calligraphy, all the subjects,
mm-hmm.
right? All the subjects that we never got in public school. And of course, they had to learn the art of eroticism and seduction. They had to be sexperts to keep the sultan interested while they were in bed. And they had to be smart and witty enough to keep him entertained.
Yeah.
You know, she couldn't be some boring, walking, hot piece of ass. You had to have something to say, too, or at least be able to hold up a fun conversation.
And again, you know, you're trying to build the next sultan out
right.
of this person. So you want someone who can grasp some shit,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So it's not just about looks.
Right. And by all accounts, Roxolana was very intelligent. She had a really great temperament. She was pretty joyful. And that got her her name, Hürrem, or Cheerful One. And it didn't take long for the Sultan to fall in love with her. Apparently, he slept with her once.
Oh, wow.
And never stopped. That was it. She became like the number one choice pretty quickly. And he kind of neglected pretty much the entire rest of the harem for her. So, of course, she got pregnant pretty early. She ended up having a son, Mehmed. The next year. And then, defying 200 years of tradition, he continued to sleep with her. And she had 5 more kids with him. Remember, the whole idea is that concubines only had one son each. That was the rule, because they didn't want multiple sons jockeying for power, right? But Suleiman was so into Hürrem, he didn't really care about, you know, these traditions. They seemed silly to him at this point. He's like, no, I love this woman. This is it. We're going to keep sleeping together. Sure, we got kids. I'm raising a family. We're going to get a dog. I'm going to put a fence up. You know, we're going to go to Little League games.
Wow.
Different culture.
But yeah, this came as a bit of a surprise for Suleiman's first favorite, Mahidevran. She was the mother to his first son, Mustafa. So she was the favorite. She was the wife. She was, in fact, still called his first wife, even while he was neglecting her for harem. So she would have been higher in the harem when Hürrem got there, but she was quickly usurped. And it did not, like, again, it wasn't even a full year before he's like, I'm done with the rest of y'all.
Wow.
So Mahidevran had been with him since he was a prince and had his baby and everything when he was a prince.
Wow.
But then got shunted to the side. And that brings us to this episode's side piece.
Excuse me?
Not that much is known about Mahidevran. But as I said, she was in his princely harem when he was the governor of Manisa. He brought her back to Constantinople with him. And her name meant one whose beauty never fades in Persian. She had his first son, Mustafa. So she's enjoying this nice wage, comfy palace life as the favorite until Hürrem comes along. And this Venetian ambassador, Cardinal Bernardo Navagero, wrote that a bitter rivalry sprang up between the two women, resulting in Mahidevran attacking and beating Hürrem, which displeased Suleiman, so he banished her back to Manisa with her son Mustafa. But Turkish historians say that is not true. That was just some nonsense spread around, probably to make Hürrem look like an asshole, because a lot of people tried that over the years.
I see.
And it was actually common practice for the mother to accompany her son when he was given governorship of a province. So Mustafa was like Suleiman. He was one of the older sons. He was given this big province, Manisa, to deal with in the regular course of things. And she went with him normally. It was not like a banishment. But history loves a catfight, so.
Yeah. Hürrem had 5 sons and 1 daughter with Suleiman over the next decade. During that time, she continued her education in diplomacy and the Ottoman language, mathematics, history, alchemy. She learned how to make perfume. And she also started to influence politics at this point, right? She becomes one of Suleiman's most trusted advisors. And she starts handling foreign affairs and international politics in this, like, totally unprecedented way for a concubine, especially. She would sit and watch council meetings through this wire mesh window. So I guess she was, like, was she sneaking in to watch them? Or was she, like, allowed
sure
to watch
them? I'm sure
they
knew about it. I think he knew that she was
It was just like, you just can't be in here, but...
Well, they can't see her.
I see. Right.
It's even more, like, it's funny because it feels like, oh, it's this prison that you keep these women in. But it was almost like for their protection or something.
Yeah.
And like, they're so beautiful that you don't get to see them.
Yeah.
They're just for me, the Sultan.
Yeah, they could see you, but you can't see them. They're like the shadow people.
Don't look over there.
So she watched these council meetings and she oversaw massive construction projects. Even one time she wrote a letter to the King of Poland just to congratulate him on his ascension to the throne. And express hope for a peaceful relationship between them. And then she created this Polish-Ottoman alliance. Apparently he wrote back a very gracious reply.
Mm-hmm.
Now she would be the first and only female sultan to exchange letters with a king.
Wow.
Yeah, after her, the female sultans would correspond with queens maybe, but never kings. This was a one-and-done situation. Crimean historians say that she actually intervened to control Tatar slave raiding too. Basically, Hürrem was running shit while Suleiman was away on military campaigns. He was expanding the empire, and she was just handling it like a boss back home. and she became his eyes and ears while he was gone.
She's just smart, not idle. She was really interested in a lot of different things. I mean, people really paint this as like she was this grasping, ambitious, cunning woman. But right. to me, she kind of reads more like someone who's just super interested and smart yeah. and was like probably telling him like, well, why don't you do this? And he was like, you know, it's a damn good idea. Why yeah. don't I do that? Why don't any of these dudes ever think of that shit?
Right.
Why don't you listen in on a wire through that wire mesh window and tell me what I should do? You know what I mean? Like, I think she just had good ideas that he was like, I'm into it.
It really like harkens back to me. Our very first episode of mm-hmm. Madame de Pompadour.
I thought about her a lot,
too. With Louis XV, mm-hmm. someone who just like came in and was like, yeah, my whole job is to marry the ruler and be his wife or his girlfriend. But while I'm here, I'm no idiot and I'm actually engaged and I'm interested and I'm going to apply all of my knowledge and be a part of things and not just kind of be a wallflower here.
Well, and like Pompadour, Harem cared about the kingdom.
Right.
Right. So I right. think the other thing that frustrates me about people being like, oh, she was just grasping for power is that it's like there's no women in the world who give a fuck about their own country.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like I was like, I think she was really like, well, I care about the empire just like anybody else. Yeah. And I have some good ideas. So I'm going to come in here and do whatever I can to help, you know, my husband run this insane empire that he's building.
Right. Right.
Anyway, you draw your own conclusion. In 1533, Mustafa is given his governor position in Manisa, Mahadevran and Mustafa leave the palace, and in 1534, Suleiman's mother, Hafsa Sultan, the Valid Sultan, she dies. So now Harem's in charge of the harem. She's the HBIC also right. within the harem.
Right.
So essentially, she's running the entire palace. She's domestic domestic and international affairs all in one.
Are they married?
No.
Okay.
Not legally. She's called a wife because she had a son.
Okay.
If they had a son, they were called a wife, but they weren't actually
right.
the sultan's wife, like okay. the queen, kind of. But she kind of was like, you know what? I want to marry the sultan. I want to marry him.
Right.
So she asks him, can I learn about Islam? Because I really want to convert. You know, she's an Orthodox Christian when she was enslaved. And so she's like, you know, I just really, it's calling my name, this religion. And he's thrilled. He's so excited. In fact, he decided to free her. So because he was so happy.
She's
I know. Right? You didn't think of that before. So she's not a slave anymore, which means she actually can get married. Because before that, she couldn't, obviously.
So, you're my girlfriend, the mother of my 5 children. Maybe it's about time I make you not a slave anymore.
It's more than Thomas Jefferson ever did.
Oh.
Happy 4th of July. Anyway.
Take that, TJ.
So then she converts to Islam. She does her studies. She gets through them, whatever. She converts to Islam. And then she tells Suleiman, well, now I'm a Muslim, and that means I can't sleep with a man who's not my husband. So sorry, you can't come in.
Wow.
And bars him from her room. And apparently it worked. According to ancient origins, he resisted for 3 days, but then married her in a magnificent ceremony. And she became Harem Sultan.
That's clever.
Amazing. I love it. The steps are pretty funny. And she broke tradition yet again by remaining at the palace for the rest of her life instead of following any of her sons to their governorships because he didn't want her to go anywhere. He
yeah.
wanted her close.
Yeah. So all this power and influence totally shocked everybody. And they hadn't seen this before. I mean, a slave had risen to the heights of becoming a legal wife of the sultan. This woman is running the show and people are just mind blown. And rumors start circulating that Harem was a witch who had put Suleiman under a spell because, of course.
Witch, you're a witch.
Anytime a woman applies herself and gets something done in history, she's got to be a witch. Mm-hmm. And then if she's a witch, that means that she's controlling people with her magic powers and causing them to do terrible things. Just that cycle back again.
Which I'm not saying women don't have magic, because we do.
Sure.
But it's not like that.
It's not like you can snap your fingers and the dishes are done.
I wish.
I know, right? That would be some magic.
I could get some bewitched magic. That would be pretty good.
Oh, man, right? A little Samantha action in here.
Well.
My first crush.
Samantha?
Yeah, Elizabeth Montgomery on Bewitched.
Oh, I actually never saw Bewitched. I saw the Nicole Kidman movie
I didn't
remake,
see that.
And it was not good.
Well, that doesn't surprise me.
No.
But,
it shouldn't. Even though she's great normally, but it wasn't a very good movie to me.
Yeah, no. Samantha on Bewitched was my first crush on TV.
Mm, she was lovely.
Anyway, people are freaking out. They're calling her a witch. But Leslie Pierce, who's the author of Empress of the East, How a European Slave Girl Became Queen of the Ottoman Empire, points out that other powerful women were also emerging in politics in the 15th and 16th centuries, like Anne Boleyn and Isabella I of Castile. So she speculates the Sultan probably wanted a European-style queen to rule beside him. But it's just as likely that he really did love Hürrem and value her perspective and advice. If anything, I don't know, maybe those just coincided.
That's true. It might have been like, not only is my heart in this, but
yeah,
the politics makes sense.
Yeah. Like, I really want to fall in love with a white European wife. And then like, oh, shit, I did. Lucky me. I mean, it sounds like a movie we'd see, right? Like a rom-com where the
right.
Sultan's like, oh, you know, I have to fall in love with this woman. I have to marry this woman so she can, you know, it's good for the empire. But then they actually fall in love.
How cute.
You know, and it'll be Scarlett Johansson as Roxolana and Scarlett Johansson as Sultan Suleiman.
Perfect. But I also think that's interesting because it just kind of discounts the cultural difference, I feel like, that like a sultan would want a European-style queen. Like, I'm not sure that they really would have seen it the same way, like that was a thing that was working for Europe. You know what I mean? I'm not sure that they would have felt the same way, just considering how they were feeling about one son per woman and that sort of thing.
Right.
It's just a completely different setup.
Right.
But I thought it was interesting anyway.
Yeah.
And the way that they wrote to each other is some evidence of their actual passion for one another.
Okay.
Hürrem wrote him letters all the time because, again, she's his eyes and ears. So she was writing him news of the palace and stuff. And she would sometimes be like, write back to me. It's not just about me wanting to hear from you. I need to let people know you're still alive and doing fine, you know, because otherwise they're going to start some shit.
Right.
But she also wrote stuff like, if you ask about me, your servant who has caught fire from the zeal of missing you, I am like the one whose liver, in this case meaning heart, has been broiled, whose chest has been ruined, whose eyes are filled with tears, who cannot distinguish any more between night and day, who has fallen into the sea of yearning, desperate, mad with your love. This passionate love of yours, your slave, is burning because I have been separated from you.
He wrote back to her, at last we shall unite in souls, in thoughts, in imagination, in will, in heart, in everything that I have left of mine, in your, and have taken you with me, O my only love.
And he's also a renowned poet. He has some verses that are still quoted to this day in Turkey. And their mutual love for poetry might have been one of the first things that he liked about her, especially because when they got together to sleep together the first time, I guess they probably talked about what they were into, had a little date, and then they ended up just being like, oh, you like poetry too, let's just talk poetry. And he actually wrote a poem for Hürrem. So let's go on down to Poetry Corner and hear what Suleiman has to say about his loved one.
Throne of my lonely niche, my wealth, my love, my moonlight, my most sincere friend, my confidant, my very existence, my sultan, my one and only love, the most beautiful among the beautiful, my springtime, my merry-faced love, my daytime, my sweetheart, laughing leaf, my plants, my sweet, my rose, the only one who does not distress me in this world, my Istanbul, my Karaman, the earth of my Anatolia, my Badakhshan, my Baghdad and Khorasan, my woman of the beautiful hair, my love of the slanted brow, my love of eyes full of mischief. I'll sing your praises always. I, lover of the tormented heart, Muhibi of the eyes full of tears, I am happy.
I mean, they seem pretty hot for each other, is all I'm saying.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Total horn dogs in these letters.
The only one who does not distress me. I mean, that can be enough.
That's a lot.
I mean, even you're not the only one who does not distress me.
What?
There is no only one who does not distress me.
That's true. You stay distressed.
Yeah, it's my natural state.
He does call it Istanbul. Was it not Constantinople at this point?
It is Istanbul, not Constantinople. It's been a long time gone since it was Constantinople.
Well, why did Constantinople get the works?
If you're asking me why Constantinople got the works, I don't want to hear it because honestly, it's not our business.
Actually, the Turks called it Istanbul themselves since the 1450s when the city fell to the Ottomans. But Christians and people in the West continued to call it Constantinople until the name Istanbul was officially adopted in 1930. So it's not my business, but I did find out anyway.
Well,
if you have a date in Constantinople, she'll be waiting in Istanbul.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, buy They Might Be Giants albums and then whatever I guess they're about to sell you during this commercial break.
All right. Welcome back to the show.
So anyway, Hürrem's image is only getting worse in the kingdom because of some political shenanigans that she is blamed for orchestrating.
Of course.
So first of all, Süleyman's grand vizier was named Ibrahim Pasha. He had known Süleyman since they were young. And Süleyman had made him a royal falconer and then promoted him to vizier in 1923.
Okay, send me through history, right?
Uh-huh.
I don't get to pick.
Right.
But roll the dice. I'm getting thrown into history to be anybody at any time. There's a couple of positions that I want, but royal falconer is up there. I got my fingers crossed.
That's a pretty cool job.
The guy who's got the falcon at all times. I mean, this guy's pretty cool, right?
Probably
I mean, not
more
this
than one.
Particular guy.
Oh,
but,
yeah. No,
but a falconer.
Yeah. Right? Probably more than one falcon, too. They
oh, yeah, he's probably got
a whole
aviary of falcons, but you've always got one on your arm.
Sure, why
right?
not?
That's my whole thing.
Hanging on the glove.
If I didn't have one, people would be like, where's your falcon?
Right.
No, I got it all the time. Or I'd be like, well, he's scouting.
Mm-hmm.
She's probably she. Mm-hmm. I feel like I don't know why. I just feel like falcon females are probably better hunters. I don't know.
I don't know enough about falcons.
If any ornithologists out there,
right?
Let me know if male or female falcons are the preferred for a falconer to have on their forearm. Anyway.
Well, Ibrahim might have been a great falconer, but he was definitely a good diplomat. He achieved quite a lot. And he actually married the granddaughter of the man who enslaved him as a child, which is kind of dope to me. And it elevated him to the Ottoman elite. But he got a little arrogant, and he started kind of acting like he were the true power behind the Sultan. Sometimes he even called himself the Sultan.
Oh,
like,
he was
while
trying to be
out,
that guy.
Yeah, in the provinces and stuff. So the story is that Hürrem did not like that, and she convinced Süleyman to have him executed. But there's another story that Süleyman himself was worried about that kind of grandstanding, and he went and consulted a judge, and the judge told him the best way to handle this is to put this man to death. So either way, whether it was Hürrem or a judge, Ibrahim was strangled in his sleep in 1536, and people started to be like, oh shit, Hürrem is cold-blooded. She is making all these murders happen out of nowhere all of a sudden. And they said that she did it because Ibrahim supported Mahadevran's son, Mustafa, as heir. And Hürrem was worried about her own sons. She wanted them to get the job. So she just wanted to get everybody who supported Mustafa out of the way.
Right. Because, see, the way that it worked here was there was no official succession. You might be first in line, but that doesn't mean you're going to be the best.
Mm-hmm.
Each son would try to gain power and popularity during their governorships, and if they were selected to succeed their father, they would actually kill every one of their brothers.
Yet Süleyman did not have to do it this. Because
okay.
I was like, oh shit, Süleyman must have killed all his brothers. But actually, all his brothers had already died by the time his father died. So he was the only one left. So he never had to do this.
Lucky Süleyman.
Right. But every other sultan did.
So you wouldn't have any type of Game of Thrones, like House Tyrell, House Lannister shit mm-hmm. like that. About who was the real heir, because they'd all be dead, right? You just wipe them out before it starts to be a problem. But it's gonna, like, guarantee chaos, obviously. This guy, Bayezid I, and he died in 1403. His four sons started a decade-long civil war over who was gonna succeed him. Mehmed III was crowned in 1595, and he had all 19 of his brothers come into the throne room.
Yeah, his dad didn't neglect the harem.
Oh, right.
His dad was taking care of it.
19 brothers. So he brings them all in. He says, nothing to worry about. You're all just here to get circumcised. Which is like,
no big deal.
Hey, brothers, I need you in the other room here real quick. Oh, no, this seems like bad news. No, don't worry about it. It's just a quick circumcision for everyone. Line them up. So it's no big deal. But then they go into the room for the operation, and they were all strangled by assassins. Which, I mean, It's just like I'm expecting a circumcision and I get strangled to death instead. I don't know if that's a win or what.
I'm thinking about, because apparently they went in one by one. So I'm thinking about, you know, like by the fourth or fifth, I'd be like, well, where are they? They're not coming back out.
They're in the recovery room.
there's
some
a
ice
back door
in there. They'd put ice on it.
Don't worry. It's just a regular old circumcision.
An Austrian ambassador once wrote to the empire and he said, "The sons of Turkish sultans are in the most wretched position in the world, for as soon as one of them succeeds his father, the rest are doomed to certain death. The conduct of the Janissaries," who they were like the sultan's elite army corps, their conduct renders it impossible for the new sultan to spare his brothers. So basically, if any of them survive, the brothers, then the Janissaries would basically keep asking the sultan for raises. And if they didn't get them, they'd be like, well, then I'm going to go get the brother and help him rise to the throne. So there's just this constant threat. If you have any brothers alive, that one of them can just come take your place. So it became this like source of leverage for the Janissaries. So it was smarter to basically just ruthlessly murder every single one of your brothers, which is outrageous to me for so many reasons, because not only what they're talking about here about once you're the sultan, you have all these threats, but also like, before that, if you have any contact with those brothers, why would you not be scheming to get rid of them so that you could be the one to go in charge? So I feel like you've already got that element in that sort of monarchy where it's like if you have multiple princes, one of them's already going to have in the back of his mind, like, I should scheme to make myself the king instead of my older brother. Then add on top of that, not only if my older brother gets to be king, will I not be king, but also I'll get murdered by him. It just becomes a who can kill who first situation and just really pits people against each other.
It's weird, too, because they would grow up in the harem together with their mothers.
Right.
So it's kind of like, I mean, there's some real brotherly feeling.
Sorry, bro.
But it's in the law. Like, yeah. They probably knew from a very young age, yeah, this is the law. Y'all going to be killed one day by your brother.
So as Suleiman is aging, both Mahadevran and Hürrem are looking out for their son's best interests. Unfortunately for Hürrem, Mustafa is super popular with the army and with the general population, and they kind of really want him to take over. But of course, she wants one of her sons, Selim or Bayezid, to get the job. So it becomes a pretty sticky situation.
And again, this is the hot goss around Istanbul, but not proven. The story is that Hürrem went to her daughter, Miramah, who was married to Rustem Pasha, who was Suleiman's grand vizier since 1544. And she's like, Miramah, we got to get a whisper campaign going about Mustafa to destabilize him. He's getting too popular.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1549, there's these rumors that Mustafa's life is in danger because of Hürrem and Rustem's court alliance against him. There was some plot to make him look like a traitor, where Rustem wrote a letter to the Shah of Iran using Mustafa's seal. And then when the Shah wrote back, Rustem showed the reply to Suleiman, like, ooh, look at who your son's writing to, the enemy. This bitch is plotting against you. But around that same time, Mustafa is given a better governor position. He gets a bigger province to rule over as a reward for all his great work in the war, all the wars that he's fighting to expand the kingdom and everything. So he kind of plays off these rumors. He's like, I ain't worried about it. I'm leading campaigns. I'm kicking ass. I'm getting rewarded. I mean, everything seems to be going fine for me. So these rumors are just nonsense. I'm not worried about them. But then in 1553, Rustem's like, hey, your dad's army's halted in Persia. Why don't we go join him? Bring your army with you. He'd love to see you. And at the same time, he's telling Suleiman that Mustafa is about to march on him to kill him and replace him. So when he shows up with his army, it looks like he's, you know, coming for some business. So Mustafa walks into his father's tent like, hey, Dad, what's up? Showed up with some backup. And he gets immediately attacked. And after a long struggle, he is killed by Rustem's right-hand man.
Damn.
And apparently Mahadevran had tried to warn Mustafa about this, but he ignored her message. So anyway, answer the phone when your mama calls you.
Now, people are super pissed off, of course, because Mustafa is so popular. And they're like, Hürrem plotted this whole thing. This is a conspiracy. This is not cool. We're not happy about this. But Suleiman is, of course, like, well, let me try and chill out everybody here. Let me try and cool this thing off, lower the temperature in the room here a little bit. So he has Mustafa laid out in state at the palace and then laid to rest in a nice mausoleum, and he dismisses Rustem as his vizier. After a couple of years, he ended up bringing him back, though, so not too bad for Rustem. But this conspiracy was never really proven. Like, Mustafa's guilt was never proven or disproven. It's all kind of hearsay. There's a English professor at DeSales University, Galina Yermolenko, who says that the story helped cement the West's view of Hiram as cold and calculating, serving as a cautionary tale to princes who might want powerful women in their courts. So, could be a lot of, like, political reasons for making her look so ambitious and grasping. It's just more men being like, don't trust a smart woman, you know, she'll stab you in the back the second she gets a chance. Outrageous.
Yeah. Yeah, just to say that it was not only for the Ottoman Empire's politics, but also European politics, that they were like, yeah, let's make Hiram look like a real bitch.
Right, right. But let's look at who she was. I mean, her philanthropy pretty much made that look like bullshit, right? She was all about, like, helping the poor and commissioning schools. She built mosques. She had a women's hospital made that was still in operation today. She also established a soup kitchen that fed, like, 500 people twice a day. And her personality, too. Like, she was joyful and smiling, candid. She was open-hearted. That was her whole thing.
Just a sweet baby.
Yeah, so it doesn't really jive with this kind of picture they tried to paint of her as being this schemer. But, you know, hey, maybe that was part of the gig. Maybe that was how she pulled it off.
Like, speculation, like, station.
Right.
She's like, oh, I would never do this myself, but maybe the best thing is to just execute Ibrahim Pasha. I mean, how sad would that be? I know he's so close to you. Anyway, how about let's read some poetry while you think it over?
And he's like, that's pretty, that seems kind of cruel, but she couldn't be cruel. She's got a soup kitchen.
Or she's like, you know, it would be fun. Let's strangle your firstborn son. I think that would be super cool.
You are a very sweet girl, so it must be the right thing to do.
You have never led me wrong before.
Nah, I mean, you know, take your pick, but I choose to believe that she was actually super chill and cool and not a conniving murderer. Or maybe a little both. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. But the murder of Mustafa did start a little civil war.
A little civil war.
Between her sons Selim and Bayezid about who would succeed Suleiman, even though Suleiman's not dead yet or anything like that. He's still kicking.
Right.
But they're still trying to figure out who's going to be next. And actually, her youngest son died of grief over Mustafa being killed, which I thought was interesting, knowing that he probably would have been killed by Mustafa if he had succeeded the throne.
Right.
But again, I think it kind of speaks to the family feeling that still existed amongst them. Do you know what I mean? Because even though you'd be like, I know how it works, that's still my brother and I'm sad, I guess.
Or, speculation station, there's a civil war going on between Selim and Bayezid. What if they're like, one of them is like, oh, fuck, we got a younger brother too? I don't want this to turn into a three-way battle. Let's try and nip this in the bud, so to speak. So, oops, he died of grief. I just went into the room to see him for a second, and then he just died of grief right in front of me.
I don't know. He was definitely crying anyway when he died.
Seemed to really be grieving, and then
he was dead. Just dropped dead.
So, I don't know. That's my own speculation. I've never seen it anywhere, but...
No, I feel like it would have been found out possibly in some way, but it's totally possible.
Died of grief just seems like a real stretch.
Yeah. In April of 1558, Hiram died. She was buried in a domed mausoleum decorated with exquisite Isnik tiles depicting the Garden of Paradise that was commissioned by Suleiman and built by the royal architect Mimar Sinan. And it was said that Suleiman was so sad that he was unable to enjoy life ever again after his wife passed away.
That could also be because life wasn't super enjoyable, though. He was very old and sickly, and he supported Selim against his brother Bayezid. And in 1559, Bayezid was defeated and executed, and Selim's status as the heir was solidified. Suleiman was also fighting other fights to expand the Ottoman Empire in Hungary. Kind of a grind.
Mm-hmm.
Like, especially when he didn't have this lovely, playful wife to lighten the mood, right?
Mm-hmm. Write him, like, sweet letters.
Yeah. Just a lot of fighting and winning and stuff. And it's just like, you know.
Sons complaining about each other.
Like, God, just vying for power. I mean, that's not fun.
No.
That's hard to live a good life anyway. And then in September of 1566... Suleiman died in his tent the night before a battle. His grand vizier kept it a secret, and the Ottomans won.
So these two literally changed the Ottoman Empire forever. Their relationship, super important to history. Because obviously Suleiman expanded the empire around 70% through military and diplomatic victories. He changed the legal system to be more fair and less bloody, and his patronage of the arts ushered in the Ottoman Golden Age.
Not bad.
And harems' unprecedented power ushered in the reign of women, which was when imperial consorts had a lot more political power and influence than they ever had before, and that was all started by her. She changed completely the role of a favorite consort and of a legal wife, and as Leslie Pierce says, brought women right to the heart of government.
I would like to usher in a reign of women.
I know, if only there was a harem today.
Well, if at least right through the house, I'd like a reign of women to just pass through.
Oh, you through our house?
Yeah, a personal reign of women. Well. Like, I'd like it to, like, it's always raining men. When's it going to rain women?
Rain
Hallelujah.
Women.
Hallelujah. It doesn't fit. It doesn't fit the cadence of the song. That's the problem.
That's why it's raining men.
That's why she picked. She was like, rain and Hallelujah, it's raining women. No, it doesn't fit. Mm-mm. I guess it's going to be men.
Mm-hmm. She's like, and it's raining girls. That's not good.
No, that's creepy.
So yeah, it just goes to show, you don't have to be a giant bitch to get what you want. You don't have to be a Cersei Lannister.
Right?
Harem got what she wanted because she was smart and friendly and fun to be around.
Yeah.
And I think that's cool. I think that's unusual in history. You know, usually it's about who's the most bloody, murderous piece of shit.
Right.
And this time it was like, you know what? This cheerful girl is smart and I like her. Let's listen to her and let her have what she wants. Suleiman devoted himself to her in a way no other sultan had done before and ends up crushing it as sultan in pretty much every possible way. Is it because of her? Maybe, maybe not. But she certainly had a lot to do with it.
Yeah.
So pretty good. I mean, a lot of people died. But still, right. It's not too bad.
Right.
Not too bad for 16th century Turkey.
Right.
So yeah, that's Harem and Suleiman and their love. And I just wanted to say that Selim, her son, was known as Selim the Sot.
Oh no. He was a bad choice?
He wasn't terrible, but he wasn't great.
He was just a sot.
He was just there. Seems like he was just there. But he also did take care of Mahadevran in her final days.
Well, that's nice.
She kind of, after Mustafa was killed, she had to go off and like live somewhere else in Bursa alone or whatever. And she was kind of poor for a while. But then when Selim ascended, he sent her enough money where she could maintain Mustafa's grave. And she was able to live independently for the rest of her life. And she actually outlived all of them. Mahadevran also did pretty good.
Now, did these new traditions stick? Like, did Selim live with his wife, his lead sultan and everything like that? No, okay.
I think Harem was special.
Okay.
I think Harem was really special. Obviously, like I say, she did usher in a whole new reign of women. So there were definitely women who were taking more part in the government.
Yeah.
But I don't think that many sultans after her, or after Suleiman, neglected the rest of their harem for one above another.
Right.
And I don't know if that's because Suleiman was a type of guy who wasn't really that interested in a lot of women. He was like, this one, I like talking to her and I like sleeping with her. That's all I care about. I'm not trying to fuck around.
If you can find both.
I mean, right? Or if, you know, again, maybe Harem was really special and they didn't get that many who were hot and smart and whatever.
Yeah.
You know, worth talking to and also had something intelligent to say about politics or whatever. I would guess more the former than the latter, but I don't know.
Hard to say.
I couldn't say. I don't know. So if you know anything about the Ottoman Empire after this, love to hear it. I did read something about how a lot of Western writers say that the Ottoman Empire started to decline after this, but it's a misinterpretation of Turkish writers who were kind of saying the empire declined, but it was only because they felt like Suleiman was such a great sultan. No one else really came close to him.
Yeah. Nobody was trying to outdo
that,
him.
Yeah, it wasn't that the empire was like going downhill or something. They were just like, it just wasn't. That was the shining moment.
Yeah.
You know, and it wasn't, it never quite reached that again.
Right, right.
And of course, the West had a vested interest in making you feel a certain type of way about the Middle East, of course.
Of course, they always have.
They were like, everything went to shit after that. And it didn't really. It lasted a lot longer than and all that.
Yeah.
But I loved this story.
Yeah.
I thought it was super cool. Look at harems and all their crazy politics.
Oh,
this
yeah.
Mean girl cafeteria.
Right.
Situation that we had to deal with. And also, yeah, weirdly, a lot like the French court. It kind of called back a lot of things.
It feels like, I mean, you put people in a position of power and they need to build a structure around that to maintain their power and have people in different subpositions. You know, like you're gonna kind of anywhere in the world, like end up with a similar structure. Mm-hmm. You know, I can kind of see where the parallels came from. And I'm sure, you know, once the trading started too, they're exchanging ideas and coming in and be like,
I like this idea of a harem that you developed. Maybe I could just have at least one, like just a royal mistress, you know, something like that.
Mm-hmm. So you can see these ideas being exchanged too. And that's sort of, not homogenizing, but sort of where you start to see one being reflected in another. Mm-hmm. You kind of see these parallels across the globe in different systems. Because, you know, again, if someone's going to maintain their control over an entire empire, then they've got to build a certain kind of structure to do it with. So no surprise that they're reminiscent.
And also no surprise that if you have women around,
uh-huh.
they're going to think, how can I improve my situation?
Yep.
Using my brain and beauty and anything else I have at my disposal.
Yep.
I think that is cool. I think that's a cool characteristic.
Yep.
And also not a surprising one.
I
think that is, if they were flipped, if we were like Tesla and we flipped it exactly and it was one woman and several men or whatever, then I think the men would also be trying to find a way to be the favorite and be the one that
oh,
gets
sure.
to influence, you know. I just think it's funny when you go through history, it's always like this ambitious woman is
right.
fucking trying to do some shit and just upsetting the whole apple cart or whatever. And you're like, yeah, duh.
Of course she was. She was at the bottom of a fucking apple cart.
I mean, seriously.
Who
she's like, get me the fuck out of here.
Crushed by apples.
Well, and just not realizing that the human nature of wanting to improve your situation,
yeah.
whatever it is,
yep.
however you can,
yeah.
you do try.
Yep.
So,
and if you can do it by being a good person,
great.
Then all the better.
Mm-hmm.
And for someone who's, you know, maybe naturally inclined to be a good person,
mm-hmm.
she might use goodness to get to rise. It's not conniving ambition.
Right.
It's like, I want to, if I help people, if I'm likable, I will ascend.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to do that. And it's not me being sneaky. It's just me benefiting from goodness.
Right. And I think it's kind of telling that she was really nice and kind in real life because
uh-huh.
nobody really tried to stop her.
Yeah.
I mean, there was all these rumors about her being a witch and having all these, you know, doing too much or whatever. But
yep.
nobody really tried to stop her. So I'm like, I think within the palace, they were like, yeah, cool. You know?
Yeah.
Think about all the people who might have been in charge before her who were very mean maybe and throwing shit and like acting crazy. So, it may, you know, I think that says something too, that people were like, yeah, no, this works for me. You know, however she's doing it, keep casting those spells.
Well, however you're doing it, send us an email. Let us know.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear from you as always.
Yeah, hope you enjoyed this.
Of course. And you can hit us up at romance@iheartmedia.com.
That's right. Or we're on the social media platforms, Twitter and Instagram as well. I'm at Dynamite Boom.
I'm at Oh Great, it's Eli.
And we're both at Riddick Romance. And don't forget to leave a little rating for us at Apple Podcasts and let us know how you're enjoying the show so we can share it with our corporate overlords.
That's right. Thanks so much, everybody. Enjoy your weekend and we will see you next time.
Bye.
So long, friends. It's time to go. Thanks for listening to our show. Tell your friends, neighbors, uncles, and aunts to listen to our show, Ridiculous Romance.